I can't take much more of this.
The afternoon of Sunday, the 13th of May, 2012, was crushing. To neutrals, it was the most thrilling end to a Premier League title race in history. For us, there was only the painful knowledge that we had thrown away a commanding lead. We had broken the Man United rule of not surrendering a position of power. Manchester City were England's champions. I felt pretty ragged myself, but I could see the distress in my wife. "Cathy," I began, "we have a great life, and we've had a fantastic period of success." "I know," she said, "but I'm not going out. There are too many City fans in the village." Sometimes you forget that setbacks can affect your family more than you. My three sons grew used to the cycle of triumph and disaster. The grandchildren were too young to understand it. Naturally, it was worse this time because Man City were the ones celebrating at our expense. And worse because we'd had the league in our grasp and thrown it away. Of all the setbacks I endured, nothing compared to losing the league to City. I had faced 14 Man City managers since 1986, starting with Jimmy Frizzell. Finally, a manager from across town had beaten me to the line in a title race. A year later, Roberto Mancini became the 14th City manager to lose or leave the job before I stood down. Roberto went after the FA Cup final defeat by Wigan Athletic in May 2013. By then, we were league champions again for the 20th time. We had turned the tables on City, but I would not be taking them on again. At the start of the 2011-2012 campaign, I felt it was between us, City and Chelsea. After a really good start, one of our best, I found myself having to change the team a lot to accommodate injuries. Our 8-2 victory over Arsenal was their heaviest defeat since 1896, when they lost 8-0 to Loughborough Town. It could have been 20. It actually reached the point where I felt, please, no more goals. It was a humiliation for Arsenal. The climate at Arsenal was hardly serene to begin with. But we played some fantastic football that day, with the missed chances on either side. It might have been 12-4 or 12-5. Arsenal played a young boy in midfield. I'd hardly heard of him, Francisco Clan, and he barely played again. He was completely out of his depth. The player who really disappointed me that day was Ashavin, and he could have been sent off for two terrible tackles over the top of the ball. There had been a change in Ashavin. You make a mental note when a player who usually gets whacked by everybody else turns it round and starts hunting down opponents. His behaviour shocked me. Ashavin contributed nothing to that game. It's disappointing, even as an opposing manager, to see this. Eventually, Arsene took him off and sent on a younger replacement. They had players missing, obviously, and were not the same without Fabregas and Nasri. For that reason, I had discounted Arsenal as title challengers. For me, Pierre Mertesacker, the centre-back, wasn't a major signing. We've seen plenty of that type of player in Germany over the years. I didn't think he would be a handicap, but nor did I believe he would lift Arsenal to a higher tier. They needed players who could directly influence their performances and results. I saw this theme developing in Arsenal's transfer trading. We watched Marouane Chamakh, the Arsenal striker, at Bordeaux. We had good scouts in France, but they never rated him. Olivier Giroud was another purchase. Arsenal seemed willing to buy French players of that standard, and I felt they might be overestimating French football. After the 8-2 win over Arsenal came the farce of a 6-1 home defeat to City. We battered them for 40 minutes in that game. Absolutely battered them. We should have been 3 or 4 up. The referee allowed Micah Richards to boot lumps out of Ashley Young, overlooking 5 fouls in a row. At half-time, we were really controlling the game. Then we had a man sent off just after the break. If you watch it again, Mario Balotelli pulls Johnny Evans first, but our centre-back then brought him down and was dismissed. So at 2-0 down, I made a change and brought on Phil Jones, who kept flying forward. We dragged it back to 3-1 and the crowd went crazy. A famous comeback was in the cards. Fletcher had scored a wonderful goal, so we began attacking and then conceded 3 goals in the last 7 minutes. Suicide. It looked humiliating, but it was actually self-annihilation. There was never a point in the game when City looked a superior side to us. At 3-0 up, they were in a comfort zone, that's fair to say, but they were not playing a style of football that was tearing us apart. The last passage of play was a disgrace. It was comedy, and it led me to lean on Rio Ferdinand, not to gamble any longer with his pace, which had declined. At his quickest, Rio would show the attacker where to knock the ball and then take it off him. Now he was trying that with David Silva, and wasn't able to beat him in the sprint. That game was a watershed for Rio. De Gea was shell-shocked. 6 goals flew past him, and he didn't have a hand in any of them. We also lost Welbeck, who was becoming a useful asset for us. After the final whistle, I informed the players they had disgraced themselves. Then we set about fixing our attention on the defensive part of the team. There was a leak in there that we needed to correct. That remedial work led us into a period of stability where we were strong at the back. We worked on players coming back into the right positions, on concentration, and on taking the defending more seriously. We fell 9 points behind Man City with that 6-1 defeat. But by New Year's Day, the gap was down to 3 points. Losing to Blackburn Rovers at home was a real shocker, especially as it coincided with my 70th birthday. Though that was nothing new to me. On my 50th, we were beaten 4-1 by Queen's Park Rangers. I'd suspended Evans, Gibson and Rooney for having a big night out and turning up for training dishevelled. Carrick and Giggs were injured, all of which forced me to play Raphael and Ji-Sung Park in the middle of the pitch. Blackburn played well that day. We pulled it back to 2-2 and they received a corner kick, which De Gea didn't handle properly, and Grant Hanley grabbed the winner. In the meantime, United managed to name a stand after me without me knowing anything about it. When I walked onto the pitch, the two teams lined up to mark my 25 years as United manager, which was really nice. The Sunderland players, Brown, Bardsley and Richardson, all former United men, were smiling broadly and very appreciative. I felt proud of that. I was told to walk to the centre circle to meet David Gill, who had an object at his feet. I assumed he was going to make a presentation to me. But as I reached him, David turned me towards the south stand. Apparently only he and the company who did the work were aware of what was going on. It was all carried out under a cloak of absolute secrecy. David made a speech and then turned me round to see the lettering. You get some churning moments in your life when you feel, I don't deserve this. This was one. David had worked hard to think of an appropriate acknowledgement of the 25 years. That's what it was about. David threw me off by saying, we want to build a statue of you. But do you think we should wait until you finish the job? His last words during that conversation were, we must do something, but I'm not sure what it should be. The answer he came up with was humbling. I had been United manager for 1,410 games. The moment didn't cause me to think any more deeply about retirement. But after the last game of the season in 2011-2012, I said to my boys, that may be it. One more season. And then that's me. Because it did take a lot out of me. That last minute took it all out of me. Going out of the Champions League in the group stage was my fault. I took the competition for granted. We had come through previous group stages comfortably, and looking at this one I felt it would be straightforward. Though, of course, I never said that publicly. Arrested players, 2 or 3 when we played Benfica away. We came away with a draw and played quite well. Then against Basel, we were 2-0 up and cruising, but ended up drawing 3-3. They had won their first game, so it put them 2 points in front of us already. We won our next 2 games against Cluj, but Benfica and Basel were still in the chase. We played well, but only drew at home with Benfica, which meant that if we lost in Basel, we would be out. The pitch was very soft in Switzerland, and we lost Vidic in the first half to a serious injury. They had a couple of good forwards in Frey and Streller, and won the game 2-1. Against Basel at home, the players had been complacent defensively, not getting back to the ball. In the Carling Cup, we were eliminated by Crystal Palace, who prepared well against our young players. The League Cup is always regarded now as a bonus tournament. We were also knocked out of the FA Cup in the 4th round, after beating Man City earlier in the competition. Because the focus was now in the Premier League, we didn't make much headway in the Europa League, going out to Athletic Bilbao in early March with a 3-2 defeat at home. I wanted to win the Europa League and represent us in the right way. But our home record in Europe was poor. 1 win from 5 games. At that point, the malaise hits you. You've been knocked out of the Champions League group stage. You've had a 6-1 defeat to Man City. And you're out of the Carling Cup at home to Crystal Palace. You have a challenge ahead. But we were good at those. We had the energy and the wherewithal to concentrate fully on the league. Our form after that, apart from the Blackburn Rovers result, was terrific. Between January and early March, we beat Arsenal and Tottenham away, defeated Liverpool and drew with Chelsea. In February, the Suarez-Evra affair blew up again when Suarez refused to shake Patrice's hand in a game at Old Trafford. I brought the players together on the Tuesday of the game and told them, "I think you need to be big." They were not inclined to be nice about it. I stuck to my theme. You need to be bigger than them. Gradually, they changed their minds and came round to the idea of a handshake. Ferdinand, the most experienced player, also had the incident with John Terry and Anton Ferdinand in his thoughts. By the Friday, they were fine with it. There would be a handshake from Evra's side. I've watched the footage several times. Suarez seemed to quicken as he passed Patrice. Perhaps he thought no one would notice that. As Suarez passed him, Evra was annoyed and said something to him. It was all over very quickly, but the repercussions lingered. When Kenny Dalglish gave his initial pre-match TV interview, he gave the impression that Suarez had agreed to shake Evra's hand. A club of Liverpool's stature should have done something about that, but he played in the game all the same. I called Suarez a disgrace to Liverpool and said they would be wise to get rid of him. I also reprimanded Patrice for celebrating too close to Suarez as the players walked off the pitch. The whole saga had started at Anfield, with Patrice sitting in the corner looking aggrieved. "What's happened?" I asked. "He called me a black ***," Patrice said. I told him he would first have to report it to the referee. I went to the referee's room with Patrice and told the match official, "Look, Patrice Evra says he's been racially abused." Phil Dowd, the fourth official, began writing everything down. The referee, Andre Mariner, told me he thought something had happened but had no idea what it might have been. Patrice said it happened several times. Then they called in Kenny Dalglish. Later, when we were having a drink, John Henry also came in. He was introduced to me but didn't say much. Steve Clark's son was pouring the drinks. One or two from the old school came in to join us, but nothing more was said. Then it exploded in the papers. Later, Liverpool wore those T-shirts supporting Suarez, which I thought was the most ridiculous thing for a club of Liverpool's stature. I felt we handled it well, mainly because we knew we were in the right. The FA asked us several times not to discuss it, but Liverpool could not leave the subject alone. David Gill would not have allowed any manager to handle it that way, nor would Bobby Charlton. They are experienced people who know about life. There seemed nobody at Liverpool willing to pull Kenny's horns in. Suarez came to the hearing and said he had called Evra a negrito. The specialist said, "Yes, you can call your friend negrito, but you can't call a stranger that in an argument. Then it becomes racist." I left Evra out of the Europa League game at Ajax 5 days after the non-handshake at Old Trafford because it was a trying time for him and he needed a break. He's a strong wee guy. I checked on his state of mind regularly and he would say, "I'm fine. I have nothing to be ashamed of. I feel I've done the right thing. It's disgraceful what he said to me." He also said he was doing it purely for himself, on a point of principle, and was not trying to fight a larger political battle on behalf of black players. I think Kenny was falling back in the old chip on the shoulder. The problem, I felt, was that there was no Peter Robinson at Anfield. Peter Robinson would never have allowed the Suarez situation to be handled the way it was. The young directors there idolised Kenny, and there was no one to say, "Hey, behave yourself, this is out of order. This is Liverpool Football Club." Equally, no one could ever overstate Kenny's dignified and statesmanlike handling of the Hillsborough tragedy, which earned him a level of respect that no later political difficulty could nullify. After the grandstand unveiling of the statue, another great honour was the FIFA Presidential Award for 2011. At the ceremony, I was sitting beside Pep Guardiola and right in front of Messi, Xavi and Iniesta, the three musketeers. I felt privileged to be in that company. As I sat there on my own, the three made their way over towards me to shake my hand. Xavi said, "How's Scholes?" In his own victory speech, Messi said his Ballon d'Or award should go to Xavi and Iniesta. They made me, he said.
Messi is such a humble lad.
It was a really pleasurable night. Sepp Blatter, the FIFA president, had been very kind with his words, and there were video messages from Gordon Brown, Tony Blair, Jose Mourinho, Eric Cantona, Ronaldo and David Beckham. The point of the award was to recognise my 25 years at Manchester United. I said it was an honour in the twilight of my life. If you could have seen me at the end of that season, you'd have thought I was right. I didn't use mind games with City because I felt we were in control. Patrick Vieira, however, did claim it was a sign of weakness for us to bring Scholes back from retirement in January 2012. In that campaign, we had great momentum until we were beaten at Wigan, where we really didn't play well. The one that killed us was the home fixture against Everton on the 22nd of April. With 7 minutes to go, we're winning 4-2. Patrice Evra hits the post and Everton go and score. Instead of 5-2, it becomes 4-3. When we drew that game 4-4, I felt we had lost the league. City won comfortably at Wolves to reduce our lead to 3 points, with the Manchester derby at City's ground to come. It was self-destruction. I knew the City game away was bound to be tough, and I thought they would play to kill the game, slow the pace down, give fouls away in our half and move the ball to Nasri and Silva to dribble with. By then, City were versed in such clever tactics. At the Etihad Stadium, we wanted the two wide players to come in all the time to support Rooney on his own and play Jisung Park in Yaya Toure's area to work him all the time. There was nobody better at that than Park. Physically, he was not in the same league as Toure, who was in outstanding form, but I needed to try and negate the threat he posed on those marauding runs of his. But I made a mistake. Nani was terrible that night. We brought Valencia on, who did a lot better, but City went 1-0 up and killed the game. Smalling was caught out by a David Silva corner for the Vincent Kompany header just before half-time. It was hard to take. For the first 20 minutes we were fine. Our possession of the ball was good and we had a couple of half chances. What we decided to do was keep the channels tight. Zabaleta kept getting to the byline and winning corner kicks. Nothing came from Clichy's side. It was all Zabaleta. And it was a corner kick that did for us. If we had made it to half time at 0-0, we would have won the game. We had a plan for the second half, a way to play that involved Welbeck coming on for Park. But Nigel de Jong did him straight away through the back, and that was Danny out for the rest of the season, until he played for England. De Jong was only booked for the tackle down Welbeck's ankle. Roberto Mancini was badgering the fourth official through the whole game. It was Mike Jones, who I feel is not one of the stronger officials. When de Jong landed the tackle on Welbeck, Mancini came rushing out to protect his player. I told Mancini where to go. That's what our little clash was about. Roberto tried to dominate the fourth official, and I had seen enough. He wanted the referee to come over to him and speak to him, so he could get the home crowd going. Andre Mariner left it to Mike Jones to sort out. Yaya Toure was the one who made the difference, no doubt about that. He was the best player against us in the 1-0 game. He was brilliant. There was no animosity later. Roberto and I had a drink. With the exception of Frank Sinatra, just about everyone was in the office where we tried to talk. The place was mobbed. I said to Mancini, "This is ridiculous. How can we have a chat with all these people in the room?" The one surprise about Mancini in his time as City manager was his stance over Carlos Tevez. He had a chance to make a stand over player power, and I felt he should have thrown him out. Instead, after their clash at a Champions League game in Germany, Tevez went to Argentina for 3 months, playing golf, and then came back saying he wanted to fight to win the league for them. Taking him back showed desperation. Or perhaps Sheikh Mansour intervened to end the standoff. I do remember Mancini saying, "He'll never play for me again." Say, Edin Dzeko or Balotelli were not happy and had disappeared for 3 months. Would they have been treated differently from Tevez? Mancini made a rod for his own back. In terms of his prestige as manager, he let himself down. I was told that some of the players and staff didn't like him, but he was not there to be liked. Results backed up his methods. He chose his players well, with a good balance and age range. I believe he wanted to avoid players over 30 and those under 24. His players were mostly in that band of 24 to 28. Most of them were at their peak, which, in theory, gave him 2 to 3 years with that squad. Tactically, you saw his Italian instincts. As soon as City went in front, he would often play 5 at the back. He had that defensive mentality. Give nothing away. That cost you some games. Goal difference was still a factor, though. In our 2 remaining games against Swansea and Sunderland, we attempted to close the gap. Against Swansea, Smalling and Giggs missed chances. We could have gone in at half-time 5 up.
In the second half, Rooney and Cleverley both missed sitters.
If we had won 5-0, we would have been 5 goals adrift. In the Sunderland game, their goalkeeper was out of this world. Simon Mignolet. His saves were incredible. We hit the post 2 times. Rooney hit the bar. We could have won 8-0. What a way that would have been to win the league. On goal difference. In the event, Rooney's 34th goal of the season from a Valencia cross was our only mark on the scoreboard. Their fans were wonderful. I kept looking at the young boy from Sky, and he was saying it was still 2-1 at City. How long to go? 5 minutes added time. But I knew. City scored 2 in 125 seconds, through Dzeko and Aguero. Dzeko's was timed at 91 minutes 15 seconds. Then Aguero went right through QPR's defence, exchanging passes with Mario Balotelli, and struck the shot that won them the title for the first time in 44 years. The clock showed 93 minutes 20 seconds. We were champions for 30 seconds. When our whistle blew, we were champions. In fairness to our players, they knew they had ballsed it up. There were no excuses. I told them, you walk out of that door with your heads up. You've got nothing to be ashamed of. Don't show any weakness. They understood that message. Their interviews were all positive. I did what I had to do. Congratulate City. I had no problem with that. There is no point torturing yourself over what might have been in the City QPR game. In my career at Manchester United, we came back time and time again, and we would do it again. The question in my mind that summer was, would City get better? They had the confidence from winning the league. There were no boys in their team, and they were a very experienced side in that mid-20s range. Money was not an object, but the size of the playing staff and the wage bill were, in the context of the financial fair play regulations. I asked of us, could we get through the following campaign with a better injury record? There was a young Paul Scholes missing from our team. We needed that kind of playmaking influence. People spoke about Modric, but we were reluctant to deal with Spurs after the Berbatov carry-on. Raphael was developing into a really, really good player, but he made mistakes. Some players can never stop making mistakes. It's hereditary, but others learn by them. Raphael was sent off against Bayern Munich and then improved his disciplinary record dramatically. He's such a competitive boy, quick and aggressive, and he believes in himself. He has a really positive attitude to the game. One thing we lacked was cover at left back, where Patrice Evra had been averaging 48 to 50 games a season. We needed to fill that breach. I said in a press conference to our fans, you better get used to this, because we're going to be seeing a lot of this new Man City. There will be a lot of games between us, and they will all be like this. I would love to have been in their Champions League group the following term, because it would have made us alive to it. For the 2012-2013 campaign, I resolved to leave no man behind and take the group stage much more seriously to win the group. Before the final round of Premier League games, Mick Phelan and I had been to Germany to see the German Cup final, to watch Shinji Kagawa, Robert Lewandowski and Mats Hummels. And I had told them, Mick, the only way City will beat us tomorrow is if they score late on. They'll have a hard game against Queen's Park Rangers. I wouldn't be surprised if QPR get a result, but if City score late on, we'll lose the league. We finished with 89 points, the highest total ever for a runner-up. The general feeling was we lacked a bit of stability in the defensive positions, particularly with the injury to Vidic. But once Evans and Ferdinand formed a partnership, we shot up the table. Our goal difference was good, and 89 points was a healthy return. But those early departures from League Cup, FA Cup and Champions League obliged us to mark it down as a bad season. I was sad, but not demoralised. I felt I had a core of players who were sure to improve. Raphael, Jones, Smalling, De Gea, Cleverley, Welbeck,
Hernandez. I had a nucleus who would be good for the long haul. The challenge was replacing Scholes. I don't know where you find those players. A fit Anderson would make up part of the gap. We were planning to sign Kagawa and a young boy, Nick Powell, from Crewe. We had 5 natural centre-backs, plus Valencia and Nani. Young would give us plenty of options wide. We knew where the challenge was. The noisy neighbours. It would suit us, I decided, if they fared better in Europe and grew distracted. On the Tuesday, we were down to go to Belfast to play in Harry Gregg's testimonial. It was hard to lift the players, but it turned out to be quite inspiring because Harry Gregg had been a great servant and the support was wonderful. It helped us push the disappointment through the system. A postscript to that painful denouement was a medical scare. I travelled to Berlin to see the Dortmund-Bayern German Cup final, then to Sunderland, then back to Manchester, then to Belfast for Harry Gregg's testimonial, and then back home, and on to Glasgow, where I was supposed to speak at a Rangers function, with a flight booked to New York on the Saturday. Shaving in Glasgow, I noticed a drip of blood, then another, and another. I just couldn't stop the flow, and ended up in hospital, where they cauterised it. The doctor thought I would be all right to fly, but it didn't stop bleeding for 2 days, so we cancelled the New York trip. The doctor came round on the Friday, Saturday and Sunday. It was painful, but eventually settled down. I used to get nosebleeds as a player, mainly from knocks, but this was an especially bad one. The cause was diagnosed as too many flights, too much cabin pressure. It was a wee warning. If you do too much, you're inviting trouble. 23. Family. She always waited up for me. Even if I came through the door at 2 or 3 in the morning, Kathy would be there to greet me. "Why don't you go to bed?" I would say to her over the phone as we travelled home.
"No, no,"
she would say.
"I'll wait till you get back."
For 47 years she maintained this line. I could go about my work and football knowing family life was completely taken care of. Kathy is a remarkable person. David Gill was a genius to persuade her to unveil a statue of me at Old Trafford. There is no way I could have coaxed her into the light like that. The truth about Kathy is that she's never changed. She's a mother, a grandmother, and a housewife. That is her life. She doesn't court friendships. It's not that she discourages them, more that she prefers the company of family and a few close friends. She almost never went to the football. When I married her, we would go to dances at weekends with friends from Glasgow. She was always comfortable in Glaswegian company. But after I moved to the United, she wasn't a social animal at all. She displayed no inclination to go out on the circuit, and I would go to most functions and dinners on my own. A house with gates is useful for when Tory politicians come canvassing. Kathy would hear the local Conservatives announce themselves to the tannoy and say, "Sorry, Mrs. Ferguson's out. I'm the cleaner." In all respects, she is faithful to her roots. When I stopped playing at 32 and had pubs in Glasgow and managed St. Mirren, my day started at Love Street, where I would be until 11 o'clock, and then to the pub until 2:30 p.m. Sometimes I would go home and sometimes directly to Love Street for training. Then it was back to the pub, then home. So the children seldom saw me at that very early age. Kathy brought them up. By the time they reached manhood, they were closer to me, but have always had the utmost love and respect for their mum. Going to Aberdeen was a blessing, because I didn't have the pubs and there was more of a family life for the 5 of us. I was there all the time unless we had a game. Darren was a ball boy and Mark would go to the games with his pals. Kathy would take Jason, who wasn't hugely interested in football at this stage. But at 13 or 14, he took up playing and ended up representing Scotland Boys Club against Wales. He wasn't a bad player. He was a late developer who was interested in books. He's a very clever boy. When we moved to Old Trafford, he stayed in Aberdeen to continue his studies. Then he joined us in Manchester, where he played for our B team a few times. Darren was always a natural, with a left foot of great quality. Mark was a very good player who appeared for Aberdeen reserves a few times. He went to college and polytechnic in Sheffield for a land economy degree. Mark became a great success in the city. All my sons have done well. They are all driven people, as is Kathy, who is clever and has a determination about her. People used to say I was like my dad. But people who really knew me said I was more like my mother, who was a very determined woman. My father was too, but was much quieter. My mother, like all good mothers, was the boss. She ran the family. Kathy made all the family decisions in our house too, which was fine by both of us. When Darren was 14, Brian Clough called and said he wanted to sign him for Nottingham Forest. Brian was full of contradictions. He would never answer the phone to me. It was always Ron Fenton, Clough's assistant, who picked up the receiver. At Aberdeen, I went south to see Forest play Celtic in the UEFA Cup on rock-hard, frosty ground. I knew Ron Fenton reasonably well. As I entered the director's lounge, Ron said, "Alex, have you met the boss?" I hadn't, and was quite looking forward to making his acquaintance. Ron introduced me, and Brian said, "What did you think of the game?" My opinion was that Celtic had deserved to win. I then told him Forest would beat them at Celtic Park. "Well, young man, I've heard enough," said Brian, and walked out. Archie Knox burst out laughing. In the event, Darren stayed with us at United. The problem was keeping him in the first team. Kathy never forgave me for selling him. He started the first 15 games in the year we won the league for the first time. But in a Scotland under-21s game, he sustained a really bad hamstring tear that kept him on the sidelines for 3 months. That was him out until February, and by that time Brian Robson was back fit. Neil Webb, McPhelan and Paul Ince were also on the scene. Then Roy Keane became available for £3.75 million. That killed Darren as a first-team player. He came to see me and said it wasn't working for him. He said he would need to move. He was also sensitive to the difficulties for me. So we sold him to Wolves, a club in turmoil, with big expectations and a large fan base. I watched Darren play there a lot. He was easily the best footballer, but they changed manager so many times after Graham Turner was sacked. Graham Taylor, Mark McGee, Colin Lee. When McGee came in, his appearances started to dwindle. He then moved to Sparta Rotterdam, and once more did well. They changed the coach while he was away on holiday, and the new man didn't want him. He then came back to Wrexham and became settled there. As his playing career wound down, Barry Fry called from Peterborough and asked what Darren was doing. He ended up as manager there and got them promoted to the Championship, where they punched well above their weight. Tensions crept in with the chairman and he resigned and went to Preston, which was a disaster, before a second stint at Peterborough displayed his qualities again. Darren's approach is to play penetrating football with players who pass the ball and move. That's hard when you're bottom of the league, because teams down there tend to be desperate. It was poignant for me to see Darren face the struggles I encountered in my early years with budgets and chairmen and players. I reminded him all the time about that motto of ours, sweeter after difficulties. My advice to any young coach is to be prepared. Start early. Don't leave until you're 40 to acquire your coaching badges. I was totally opposed to fast-tracking coaches. It's a disgrace. In Holland and Italy, it might take 4 or 5 years for you to receive your badges. The reason they need to go through that intense, prolonged scrutiny is to protect them from what's to come in management. It cost Darren £8,000 to earn his badges at the Warwick Business School. By fast-tracking big names, the FA rode roughshod over all the people who scraped together to get their qualifications the proper way. I didn't talk to myself about being away a lot or consumed with work during the boys' childhoods. The reason was that we were all very close regardless, and the boys themselves were very tight-knit. They are in constant contact with us. They're all busy lads. Even I couldn't always get hold of Mark, who was in a business where you have to keep your eye on the ball. His is a world of tiny fractions, where you could miss a buy or a sell in seconds, the way the markets move. All my sons are a credit to Kathy, who was always there for them, and for me, whatever time I turned the key in the door. 24. Rooney. It was August 2004, and we had just played Everton. Bill Kenwright was crying, sitting in my office. Crying. Present were David Moyes, David Gill, Bill and me. As we studied the Everton chairman in his sorrow, he announced that he would like to make a call. Through his tears, Bill said, "I'll need to phone me mother. They're stealing a boy. stealing our boy, he said down the line. Then he passed the phone to me.
Don't you dare think you're getting that boy for nothing. That boy's worth £50 million,
said a female voice. Wonderful. This is a trick, this, I laughed. Is this a game? But it was real. You had only to mention Everton to Bill to turn his taps on. He was a very likeable guy and unapologetically emotional. David Moyes was giving me the eyes. For a minute, I thought it was a get-up, a performance. Bill's background was in theatre, after all. It occurred to me, while all this was going on, that I ought to check Wayne's medical records. Was there something physically wrong we had missed? Was this a ruse to push the price up? My God, it was funny. Did the boy have one leg? Was I being lured into a gigantic sting? The negotiations to buy England's most promising young talent were protracted, to say the least. Bill knew the value of the boy. David Moyes was the more combative party, as I would have been in his position. David was realistic. He knew the club were about to receive a healthy fee, and that Everton were hardly awash with money. The official price was just over £25 million with add-ons. Everton needed that injection. When the tears had dried and the talking was over, Wayne signed on the line 7 hours short of the deadline on the 31st of August 2004. By the time he joined us, he hadn't played for 40-odd days and had trained for only a couple of sessions. We thought the Champions League tie at home to Fenerbahce would be a suitable introduction, 28 days after he'd become a Manchester United player. This tentative approach yielded a spectacular return, a Rooney hat-trick in a 6-2 victory. After that dramatic introduction, his fitness level dropped a bit, and we had some work to do to bring him to the level of the other players. Understandably, there was no repeat of the Fenerbahce performance for several weeks. None of this stifled my enthusiasm for him. Wayne possessed a marvellous natural talent and was entitled to be given time to make the transition from boy to man. He was a serious, committed footballer with a hunger for the game. At that point in his development, Wayne needed to train all the time, and did so willingly. He was never the sort who could take days off. He needed to train intensively, to be on the sharp edge of his game. Whenever he was out for a few weeks with an injury, Wayne's fitness would drop quite quickly. He has a big, solid frame and broad feet, which may partly explain his metatarsal injuries in that period. I knew straight away that he was the player our intuition said he would be. Courageous, reasonably two-footed, though he uses his left foot less than he could. We signed players at 24, thinking they would peak at 26, and Wayne's progress with us from a much earlier age supported my conviction that he would be at his best around that age. With the kind of physique he had, it was always hard to imagine him playing into his mid-30s, like Scholes or Giggs. But I developed an expectation when he re-signed for us, in October 2010, that he might end up as a midfielder. All our intelligence about Wayne Rooney as an Evertonian schoolboy could be condensed into a single phrase. This was a man playing in underage football. The reports at our academy were always glowing, and the club tried to acquire him at 14, when there is a loophole in the last week of May that allows you to sign a boy from another academy. But Wayne wanted to stay at Everton. We tried again at 16 before he signed his academy forms, and again he wasn't interested. Everton were in his blood. Geoff Watson and Jim Ryan were our two academy men who had monitored Rooney's progress and had been so impressed with him in games between the clubs. He played in the FA Youth Cup final at 16 against Aston Villa. When Walter Smith joined me as assistant, he said, "Get that Rooney signed." Walter was unequivocal. He described him as the best he had ever seen. That confirmed everything we knew of him. Then came Wayne's debut at 16 and his wonder goal against Arsenal. At Everton, he also became the youngest player to win a full England cap in a game against Australia, and was then picked by Sven-Göran Eriksson for the vital European Championship qualifier against Turkey. He scored his first international goal at 17 years and 317 days, so he was already on the national map by the time he came to us. My first meeting with him contradicted my expectation that he would have an assertive personality. He was a shy boy. But I think there was an awe about him that reflected the large transfer fee and all the attention it was bringing. He soon stopped being shy. On our training ground, He gave everybody hell. Everybody. The referee, the other players. The poor refs, Tony Stradwick or Mick or Rennie, would all say to me, "You're the only one with authority. You should ref these games." My reply was, "There's no way I'm refereeing these matches." I remember Jim blowing his whistle mildly for a foul on a day when Roy Keane was in one of his dark moods, giving everyone stick. His team, our team, the ref, any living creature he could find. Jim turned to me with his whistle and said, "I hope Roy's team wins." "That's ridiculous, that," I said, trying not to laugh. "Yeah, but the grief I'll get in that dressing room," Jim said. At one point we even discussed hiring referees. I admit, I gave Wayne a few rollickings, and he would rage in the dressing room when I picked him out for criticism. His eyes would burn, as if he wanted to knock my lights out. The next day, he would be apologetic. When the anger subsided, he knew I was right. Because I was always right, as I liked to tease him. He would say, "Am I playing next week, boss?" "I don't know," I would say. In my opinion, he was not the quickest learner, but what he had was a natural instinct to play the game, an intuitive awareness of how football worked, a remarkable raw talent, plus natural courage and energy, which is a blessing for any footballer. The ability to run all day is not to be undervalued. In a training ground exercise, he wouldn't absorb new ideas or methods quickly. His instinct was to revert to type, to trust what he already knew. He was comfortable in himself. In those early days, I seldom had to be dictatorial with him. He made some daft tackles in games and there were flashpoints on the pitch. Off the field, though, he caused me no anxiety. My problem was that, being a centre-forward myself, I was always harder on the strikers than anyone in the team. They were never as good as me, of course. I'm sorry, but none was as good as I was in my playing days. Managers are allowed such conceits and often inflict them on players. Equally, the players think they are better managers than the men in charge. Until they try it, that is. If I saw attackers not doing the things I believe I used to do, it would set me off. They were my hope. I looked at them and I thought, "You are me. You see yourself in people." I could see myself in Roy Keane, see myself in Brian Robson, see bits of me in Paul Scholes and Nicky Butt, and the two Nevilles, Gary and Phil. Teams reflect the character of their manager. Never give in. That's a great religion, a great philosophy to have. I never gave in. I always thought I could rescue something from any situation. Something was always happening at Man United. There was always a drama. It was routine to me. When Wayne Rooney's personal life was exposed in the News of the World, and a sense of crisis was brewing in his world in the late summer of 2010, there was no council of war in my office, no pacing of the room. I didn't phone him the morning after the story broke. I know he would have wanted me to. That's where my control was strong. He would have been looking for a phone call from me, an arm round his shoulder. To me, that wasn't the way to deal with it. When these sorts of allegations surfaced the first time, he was 17 years old, and allowances were made for his youth. But this time, we were 7 years on. Colleen, his wife, had her head screwed on. She always struck me as a stabilising force. I certainly felt under pressure in relation to him during that World Cup in South Africa. I knew there was something bugging him at the 2010 World Cup. I could see it. Although he'd been named PFA Player of the Year and Football Writers Association Footballer of the Year that season, he was in a strange mood in South Africa. "Nice to see your home fans boo you," he said into a TV camera after England's goalless draw with Algeria in Cape Town. England went out in the second round, and there were no goals in 4 matches for Wayne. I needed to get his attention. Yet, the best way to achieve that was by not saying anything to him, not offering consolation, to force him to think. When I left him out away to Everton in September to protect him from abuse by the crowd, he was relieved, because he knew I was doing the right thing by him. Your job is to make an impact on each personality with the best possible output in terms of performance. We can all moralise, but everyone will commit indiscretions. I was never going to moralise with Rooney. On the 14th of August 2010, Wayne informed us he would not be signing a new contract at United. This was a shock, as the plan had always been to sit down after the World Cup to discuss a new contract. As the drama gathered pace, David Gill called me to say that Wayne's agent, Paul Stretford, had been to see him to say that Wayne wanted away. The phrase he had used was that he didn't think the club were ambitious enough. We had won the League Cup and the league the year before and reached the final of the Champions League. David said that Wayne would be coming to see me. At that meeting, which was in October, he was hugely sheepish. I felt he'd been programmed in what he was trying to say. The basis of his complaint was that we were not sufficiently ambitious. My response was to ask Wayne, when have we not challenged for the league in the last 20 years? How many European finals have we been to in the last 3 or 4 years? I told him that to say we weren't ambitious was nonsense. Wayne said that we should have pursued Mesut Ozil, who had joined Real Madrid from Werder Bremen. My reply was that it was none of his business who we should have gone for. I told him it was his job to play and perform. My job was to pick the correct teams. And so far, I had been getting it right. We had a European tie the following day. 2 hours before we played Bursaspor, on the 20th of October, Wayne issued the following statement. I met with David Gill last week, and he did not give me any of the assurances I was seeking about the future squad. I then told him that I would not be signing a new contract. I was interested to hear what Sir Alex had to say yesterday, and surprised by some of it. It is absolutely true, as he said, that my agent and I have had a number of meetings with the club about a new contract. During those meetings in August, I asked for assurances about the continued ability of the club to attract the top players in the world. I have never had anything but complete respect for MUFC. How could I not have done, given its fantastic history and especially the last 6 years in which I have been lucky to play a part? For me, it's all about winning trophies, as the club has always done under Sir Alex. Because of that, I think the questions I was asking were justified. Despite recent difficulties, I know I will always owe Sir Alex Ferguson a huge debt. He is a great manager and mentor who has helped and supported me from the day he signed me from Everton when I was only 18. For Manchester United's sake, I wish he could go on forever because he's a one-off and a genius. I wasn't sure what he meant by this statement, but I assumed he was trying to build some bridges with me and the fans. I hoped it meant he'd changed his mind and was happy to stay with us. The press conference after that game, when all the media were there, gave me an opportunity to say what I wanted to say, which was that Wayne was out of order. I told the press, as I said, 3 Premier League titles in a row is fantastic, and we were within 1 point off a record fourth. It didn't happen for us, and we didn't like that, and we want to do something about it. We'll be okay. I've got every confidence in that. We have a structure at the club, which is good. We have the right staff, the right manager, the right chief executive. He's a brilliant man. There's nothing wrong with Manchester United. Not a thing wrong with it. So we'll carry on. And, as I said in television, I had a meeting with the boy, and he reiterated what his agent had said. He wanted to go. I said to him, just remember one thing. Respect this club. I don't want any nonsense from you. Respect your club. What we're seeing now in the media is disappointing, because we've done everything we can for Wayne Rooney, since the minute he's come to the club. We've always been there as a harbour for him. Any time he's had a problem, we've given advice. But you do that for all your players, not just Wayne Rooney. And that's Manchester United. This is a club which bases all its history and its tradition on the loyalty and trust between managers and players and the club. That goes back to the days of Sir Matt Busby. That's what it's founded on. Wayne's been a beneficiary of this help, just as Ryan Giggs, Paul Scholes, and all the players have been. That's what we are there for. In a conference call with the Glazers, the future ambitions of the club were discussed, and Wayne was made one of the highest paid players in the country, I would imagine. The next day, he came in to apologise. I told him, it's the fans you should be apologising to. There was a mixed reaction from the players. Some were put out, others were not bothered by him. It was a sorry episode for Wayne, because it portrayed him as a money man who had dropped his grievance the minute his salary was raised. That's the way it was presented. But I don't think it was Wayne's intention to make it a financial issue. It blew over quickly. With the fans, however, there was a residue of mistrust. He was fine so long as he was scoring. But in fallow times, there was always perhaps a stirring of the old resentment. Players can underestimate the depth of feeling for a club among fans. In the most extreme cases, it leads supporters to think they own the club. Some of them have stood behind the club for 50 years. They're there for life. So when a player is deemed to have shown disloyalty to a club, there is no messing about with them. Very few players want away from Manchester United. We had a generation of players who had pledged their whole careers to our club. Gigs, goals and so on. And it was alien to our supporters to see a player agitating for a move or to hear him criticising transfer policy. In the winter of 2011, I did have to take disciplinary action after Wayne, Johnny Evans and Darren Gibson had a night out. They went across to Southport to a hotel to celebrate our 5-0 Boxing Day win against Wigan. They came into training the next day, weary. I went into the gymnasium where they were doing their exercises and told them they would be fined a week's wages and not considered for selection against Blackburn on the Saturday. Wayne needed to be careful. He has great qualities about him, but they could be swallowed up by a lack of fitness. Look at the way Ronaldo or Giggs looked after themselves. Wayne needed to grasp the nettle. It was not wise for England to give him a week's holiday before Euro 2012 because he might lose his edge. If he missed a couple of weeks for United, it could take him 4 or 5 games to get his sharpness back. The Ukraine game was over a month after his last game for us. He would receive no leniency from me. I would hammer him for any drop in condition. It was quite simple. He wouldn't play. That's the way I always dealt with fitness issues, regardless of the player involved, and I saw no reason to change in the final years of my career. Wayne had a gift for producing great moments in games. In my final year, when he was left out a few times and replaced in games, I felt he was struggling to get by people and had lost some of his old thrust. But he was capable of making extraordinary contributions. That pass to Van Persie in the win over Aston Villa that secured the title for us was marvellous, as was his overhead kick against Man City. Those flashes guaranteed his profile. But as time wore on, I felt he struggled more and more to do it for 90 minutes, and he seemed to tire in games. I took him off in that Aston Villa game, because Villa were a very fast young side, full of running, and their substitute was running past Wayne. He came into my office the day after we won the league and asked away. He wasn't happy with being left out for some games and subbed in others. His agent, Paul Stretford, phoned David Gill with the same message. All players are different. Some are happy to stay at the same club their whole careers. Others need fresh challenges, as Van Persie felt when he joined us from Arsenal. The urge to fight and flourish would not be extinguished in Wayne. I left him to discuss his future with David Moyes, hoping to see many more great performances from him at Old Trafford. 25. The last campaign. We were hardly strangers to majestic individual talent, but it took us a while to understand just how good Robin van Persie is. The quality of his runs was not immediately apparent to even our cleverest players. Even Paul Scholes and Michael Carrick, two of the best passers I ever had trouble at first picking up the speed of his movements. Robin was the leading light of my final season as Manchester United manager, in which we were the first team to win 25 of their first 30 top-flight fixtures. The prize at the end of it was the club's 20th league title. We regained the Premier League trophy from Manchester City with 4 matches still to play. Van Persie was my final major transfer buy, and his goals, some of them spectacular, brought an extra Cantona-esque quality to an already very good side. If we had a bad habit going into the 2012-2013 season, it was overpassing in the middle of the pitch, players circulating the ball to acquire a feel of it. With Van Persie, we learned in time, you needed to look for that early pass to split the opposition defence. Until we grasped those possibilities, we could not make the most of Robin's marvellous mobility and killer instinct. But we learned the lesson in time to make it pay. If Wayne Rooney received possession in an attacking midfield position, he could be sure Van Persie would be on the move, hunting, spearing into gaps. Robin was exactly what I wanted him to be. His pre-season with Arsenal had consisted of 21 minutes playing time against Cologne in Germany, so his match fitness was slightly lacking. The right type of conditioning was already there, but we needed to get him into a match-fit state. I was deeply impressed with him from the start. I said to Robin quite early, "Don't be afraid to instruct the other players. You were the leader at Arsenal, and if you don't get fed, get into them. He was quieter than I expected, but with a vicious left foot that would freeze goalkeepers with its force. People asked why I allowed him to take corners as a centre-forward. He would take them from the right-hand side, not the left, when he would be in the penalty box. The answer is that his corner-taking from the right was terrific. Howard Wilkinson remarked to me that season that a study he had overseen had showed a decrease in the number of goals from set pieces. Yet we had scored 10 from corners in the first half of 2011-2012. The existing squad didn't see Robin as any kind of outsider, an Arsenal player creeping into their territory. Mine were a very welcoming bunch who asked only that the new arrival commit himself to the cause and respect the traditions of our dressing room. I always remember Veron arriving at the club and all the players leaving the training session to shake his hand. They were always good like that. Perhaps the greeting is always warmest for the player who might win you a tight game, an indispensable asset at the very highest level. Like everyone in the business, I had been reading that Van Persie's contract was about to expire, but I felt sure Arsenal would reach a deal to stop him leaving. Towards the end of the 2011-2012 season, however, I sensed increasingly that he would not be staying in North London. His agent contacted us. By then he had already been talking to Man City, but the message was that Robin would be very, very interested in having a discussion with us. Eventually City were advised that he would not be joining them, so it appeared to be between us and Juventus. The club had, I gathered, offered him an immense salary to move to Turin. My thinking was, there are two reasons why a player wants to move. One, for the glory, and two, for the money. I could see why he might have wanted to join Juventus, a fine team, for an astronomical reward. The package we could offer was good enough to show him how much we respected him. Our invitation was backed up with great enthusiasm. Next, we began talking to Arsenal about a possible transfer fee. David Gill phoned Ivan Gazidis, the Arsenal chief executive, a number of times, starting in April, but was told that Arsenal believed they could persuade him to sign a new deal. This carried on for a while, until David suggested I should call Arsene directly, as he would clearly have the final say on any transfer. By then, it had become apparent the boy was leaving. Arsene's attitude, understandably, was, why should we sell him to Manchester United when we could get 30 million off Man City or Juventus? My response was to point out that the player had no desire to go to our Manchester rivals. Arsene's counter-argument was that Robin's view of it might change if City made him a further offer he could not refuse. It was certainly possible. These discussions, I should say, were amicable. There was no hint of hostility. We were two experienced managers confronting reality. The sticking point was that Arsene hoped to receive 30 million or more for his best player. It continued to drag on for several weeks, during which time I phoned Arsene two or three more times. In time, we all arrived at the point where Arsenal knew Robin was not going to re-sign and accepted that. Their options were Juventus or United. Arsenal were trying to sell him abroad, but the player only wanted to join us. My understanding is that Van Persie sat down with Arsene and told him United was his preferred destination. Our offer, from David Gill to Gazidis, was 20 million. I warned Arsene that we would never get to 25 million. Arsene was incredulous. He could not believe that Manchester United would refuse to stretch to 25 million for such a player. I told him again, I wouldn't go to 25 million. Arsene asked what my best offer would be. Answer, 22 million. The reply was that Arsenal would take 22.5 million and a further 1.5 million if we won the Champions League or Premier League during the period of his contract. Deal done. My intuition was that Arsene was relieved not to be selling Van Persie to Man City, who had already taken Kolo Touré, Gael Clichy, Emmanuel Adebayor and Samir Nasri from his team. Perhaps he is not a fan of City's ownership model, and although we had many battles over the years, I think he respected the way Manchester United was run. He said that to me on occasions. I always remember Arsene saying to me about Van Persie, "You don't realise what a good player you're getting." I thought of Cantona and Ronaldo and Giggs, but Arsene was right. Robin's movement and the timing of runs were mesmerising. He was also blessed with a formidable physique. Van Persie took a lower, but still fantastic, wage from us, to come to a place where he believed he could be most successful. At his unveiling, he said his inner child had been screaming for United.